Earlier this year, prolific film director Wes Craven passed away. Craven, best known for his work in the horror genre, particularly for the films Nightmare on Elm Street, and the movie that I'm going to cover today, 1996's Scream, the first horror movie I ever saw. So that's the movie we're going to take an extended look at here on this episode of...
Everything is Fantastic!
Alright, hello and welcome to another episode of Everything is Fantastic, the podcast where I talk about things I enjoy in perhaps more detail than is necessary, but that's just the way I do things. I'm your host, Chris McGinnis, and it's good to be back. Thank you for your patience. I know I said I was going to try to do this episode in October leading up to Halloween, but October was... a very busy month for me, mostly because of rehearsals and performances of the Rocky Horror Show at Gettysburg Community Theater, which went very well, might I add. It was 6 sold-out performances over the course of 3 nights. It was absolutely incredible. And what time that I wasn't in rehearsal or in performance, I was at work, which was less enjoyable, but, you know, that ate up plenty of time. And I'd hoped to, you know, do this, you know, maybe shortly after the show had closed, but after the show closed, I was hit with a cold, which I'm more or less just now finally getting over, almost 2 weeks later. You can probably still hear it in my voice a little bit, but I wanted to, you know, wait until I had, you know, more of a voice, in order to speak, and was coughing less frequently before I went ahead and recorded this episode. And also, this is the first episode using my new blue snowball microphone. Many thanks to my friends Jen and Adam for the Amazon gift card that helped me purchase this. So here's hoping that you enjoy the higher quality audio for my podcast from here on in. But enough preamble, let's talk about 1996's horror deconstruction film, Scream. The movie begins with the sound of a phone ringing and a woman screaming as a very simple title card flashes on the screen. This is not the last time we will hear either one of these sounds. We then cut to a phone ringing on an end table. A young woman named Casey Becker answers the phone. A man's voice on the end asks who he's called, but Casey dismisses him as a wrong number and hangs up. The phone rings again. It's the same voice on the other end. Casey asks why he called back, if he realized he dialed the wrong number, and the voice says that he called to apologize. Casey says that he's forgiven and goes to hang up, but the voice tries to stop her, saying that he wants to talk to her. Casey tells the mystery caller that they've got 900 numbers for that, and hangs up again. We cut to outside where a swing is seen moving back and forth in the front yard. The leaves on the tree that it's attached to don't seem to be moving, so it seems very unlikely that the wind is making the swing move. This is a detail that I honestly never picked up on or thought about until now, rewatching it for the podcast. Back inside, Casey turns on a burner on the stove and places a container of Jiffy Pop popcorn on it. The phone rings again, and it's the same mystery person calling back. He asks Casey why doesn't she want to talk to him. Casey once again asks who it is. The caller says, "You tell me your name, I'll tell you mine." Casey doesn't bite. She shakes up the popcorn container, and the caller notices the noise, asking what it is. Casey tells him that it's popcorn. The caller says that he only eats popcorn at the movies. Casey says she's getting ready to watch a video, some scary movie. The caller utters the iconic line, "Do you like scary movies?" Casey says she does. This seems to get the mystery man's attention. He then asks the iconic question, "What's your favorite scary movie?" Now, I do fully realize that I just used the adjective iconic to describe two quotes, and I genuinely mean that, because, let's face it, if you hear either of those questions, your mind immediately jumps to Scream. Anyway, Casey says that Halloween is her favorite, and she asks the caller what his favorite is. The caller tells her to guess, and she says Nightmare on Elm Street. "Is that the one with the guy who had knives for fingers?" the caller asks. Casey tells him that's the one, then goes on to say that the first movie was good, but the sequels, which had no involvement by original director Wes Craven, sucked. Very clever. The caller asks Casey if she has a boyfriend, and Casey tells him no. The caller brings up the point he still doesn't know her name. Casey asks why he wants to know her name, and he responds, "Because I want to know who I'm looking at." Casey freezes in fear and asks him to repeat himself. The caller says he wants to know who he's talking to, but Casey says that's not what he said. She turns on the lights in the backyard and looks through her patio door, but sees no one. She then shuts off the lights and locks the back door, hanging up just as the caller tells her not to do that. We cut to a quick shot of the popcorn as the bag has inflated near bursting as the contents cook. The phone rings again, and against her better judgment, Casey answers it again. No points for guessing who it is. Casey asks the man why he keeps calling her, and he says he wants to talk. Casey tells him to dial someone else and hangs up. Not long after that, the phone rings again. Casey yells at the caller, but he yells back, saying that if she hangs up on him again, he will gut her like a fish. This seems to get Casey's attention. She asks if this is some kind of joke, and the voice replies it's more of a game. He asks if she can handle it and calls her Blondie, solidifying the fact that he can, or at least has been able, to see her. Casey runs panicked through the house, locking every door she comes across. As she peers out the front door, trying to spot the caller, Casey says she'll call the police, but the voice taunts her, saying that the police would never make it in time, they're in the middle of nowhere. Casey asks what he wants, and the voice responds, to see what your insides look like. Casey starts to cry, and she hangs up the phone once again. The doorbell rings, startling her. She calls out who's there and then reaches for the phone, saying that she'll call the police. As she picks up the phone, it rings, scaring the shit out of her. She answers, and the voice scolds her, "You should never ask who's there. Don't you watch scary movies? It's like a death wish. You might as well go outside and investigate a strange noise or something." Casey tells the caller he better leave or else there'll be trouble when her boyfriend arrives. The caller says he thought Casey said she didn't have a boyfriend. Casey says that she lied about that, but she does have a boyfriend. He's big, he plays football, and he'll kick the shit out of you. The caller seems less than threatened and asks if her boyfriend's name happens to be Steve. Casey frees up again and asks the caller how he knew that. He tells her to turn on the patio lights again. She does so, and we see a guy bound to a lawn chair with duct tape over his wrists, feet, and mouth. He's bloodied in a few places, so there's obviously been some sort of a scuffle. I'm assuming that this is Steve. Casey begins to open the door, but the caller advises her against doing that. Casey asks the caller why he's doing this, and the caller says he wants to play a game, and if Casey refuses, he'll kill Steve right now. Casey asks what kind of game, and the caller tells her to turn the lights off. Casey does so and slinks back into the living room despite Steve's muffled protests, crumpling to the floor near her TV. The caller says that the game works like this. He asks Casey a question. If she gets it right, Steve lives. It's an easy category. Movie trivia, and he even offers to give Casey a warm-up question. What was the name of the killer in Halloween? Casey doesn't want to answer, but is coaxed to do so after being told that Steve's counting on her. Casey correctly guessed Michael Myers, at which point the voice says it's now time for the real question. Name the killer in Friday the 13th. Casey yells Jason, but the caller tells her she's wrong. Casey continues to insist it's Jason, saying that she's seen that movie 20 goddamn times. The caller then says that if she's seen it that often, she should know that Mrs. Voorhees was the killer in Friday the 13th, and Jason didn't show up until the sequel. Casey feels that she's been tricked, but the caller tells her not to worry, there's a bonus round, but it appears that Steve is out of the game. We hear muffled screams and the sound of a knife stabbing flesh. Casey turns on the patio light, and we see that Steve is now dead in the chair, having been stabbed in the stomach. Casey sinks to her knees and crawls away from the patio door. The caller laughs and says there's one final question. What door is he at? Casey says she doesn't want to do this anymore, and the caller throws a chair through the glass patio door. Now, you see, if she just guessed the patio door, she would have won, and the killer would have left her alone. Casey runs into the kitchen. The popcorn is now on fire, and smoke is filling the room. She grabs a large knife from a block on the kitchen counter and walks back towards the living room. We get a brief glimpse of a black cloaked figure running across one of the halls in the background. Casey heads into the living room, makes her way to the patio door, and goes outside armed with a knife, still clutching the phone in her other hand. She peeks through the window and sees someone wearing the, here's that word again, iconic ghost-faced mask and costume running through the house. We then cut to a shot of a car driving up the road towards the house. It is later revealed that these are Casey's parents returning home. Casey tries to hide outside, hopefully to buy enough time until her parents arrive and hopefully offer assistance. Unfortunately, Casey comes face-to-face with the masked man as he bursts through a window and tries to drag her inside. She manages to fight him off and run away. The killer manages to catch up with Casey, though, and stabs her in the in the chest, throwing her to the ground. The killer begins strangling Casey, but she knees him in the groin, freeing herself temporarily. The Beckers walk up to their front door, completely unaware of what's happening to their daughter. Casey tries to yell, but can barely muster her voice above a hoarse squeak. She falls to the ground, and the killer looms over her. Casey reaches up and pulls his mask off as the camera pans up to the killer's hand, holding the knife in the air. We get one last look at Casey's face, and then the knife comes down, stabbing her. The Beckers are now in their house, and see things are in great disarray. Mrs. Becker finds the popcorn on fire in the kitchen and tosses it in the sink. She begins calling out her daughter's name, and Mr. Becker tells her to call the police. Mrs. Becker picks up one of the phones, but there's no dial tone. Casey still has the cordless phone with her, and it's still engaged in the call. Mrs. Becker can hear the pain sounds of her daughter groaning as she's attacked. Suddenly, the line goes dead. Mr. Becker tells his wife to get in the car and drive to her neighbor's to call the police. As Mrs. Becker leaves the house, she suddenly stops and screams, falling to her knees. Mr. Becker follows him and sees Casey's dead and bloody body, eviscerated and hanging from the rope of the swing in the front yard. We get a sudden cut to a young woman sitting in front of a computer, typing. This is Sydney Prescott, our protagonist. She hears a noise in the direction of her window and looks over briefly. Seeing nothing, she resumes typing. She hears more clattering and the sound of something breaking, so she decides to walk over to her window and investigate. A hand reaches through the window and grabs her. Sydney screams and sees that the hand belongs to her boyfriend, Billy Loomis. Billy enters through the window, and Sydney tells him that he can't be here because her dad is in the other room. Billy says he won't stay long, but just then there's a knocking at Sydney's bedroom door. Her dad tries to open the door, but is blocked by the conveniently open closet door. Mr. Prescott asks Sydney if she's okay, and Sydney responds, "Can you knock?" Point of order, he did knock. That's why you panicked. Anyway, Mr. Prescott says that he heard screaming, and Sydney insists that he didn't. The bedroom door opens fully, and nothing seems to be amiss. Mr. Prescott gives us some exposition that he'll be out of town all weekend, and Sydney says that everything is in hand. Mr. Prescott could have sworn he heard screaming, but Sydney just kisses his cheek and tells him to have a good trip. Mr. Prescott leaves, and Sydney shuts the door, wondering where Billy has disappeared to. Suddenly, a stuffed tiger pops up from beside the bed and says, "Close call! Oh, there's Billy, that merry trickster." Sydney asks Billy what he's doing there, and Billy says that it occurred to him that he'd never come into Sydney's room through her window before. Sydney asks if he's got that out of his system now. Billy says that he was at home watching TV. The Exorcist was on, and it made him think of Sydney. She is understandably puzzled. Billy explains it was edited for TV, so all the good parts were cut out. That made him start thinking about the relationship. We started out hot and heavy, a nice solid R rating, well on our way to an NC-17, but now we're just sort of edited for television. Okay, I know that this movie deconstructs horror tropes, but nobody talks like this. Sydney asks if Billy thought he'd come over in through her window and they'd have a little raw footage. Don't encourage him, Sydney. Billy assures Sydney he'd never dream of breaking her underwear rule, whatever that may mean, but was thinking they could do some on-top-of-the-clothes stuff. Sydney says okay, and they start making out. She does not look into it at all at first, and I find that hilarious. An almost dirge-like version of Don't Fear the Reaper plays in the background. I'm going to chalk this up as foreshadowing. As they kiss, Billy moves a hand up Sydney's leg and starts to venture beneath her nightgown. Sydney pushes his hand away and says, "Time's up, stud bucket." Stud bucket? That may be the worst term of endearment I've ever heard in my life, movie or no movie. They part company, and Billy tells Sydney that, in regard to the sex stuff, he's not trying to rush or anything. He was only half serious. As Billy climbs to the window, Sydney asks him if he'd sell for a PG-13 relationship. Billy asks what that is, and Sydney unbuttons the top of her nightgown to flash her breasts at him. They laugh, and Billy calls her a tease as he exits into the night. We cut to the next day at Woodsboro High School. Police cars and news vans are scattered throughout the campus. Sydney walks by the mad scene, aware of what's happening. She stops, somewhat fixated on one female reporter who is broadcasting from the scene. Just then, Sydney's best friend Tatum comes up to her, breaking Sydney's reverie. Sydney asks what's going on, and Tatum tells her about Casey Becker and Steve Worth being murdered, or, as Tatum puts it, splatter movie murdered the night before. The police have no leads, and Tatum's brother Dewey, a deputy on the police force, has said it's the worst murder. It's the worst that they've seen since, to quote Tatum, well, you know. More on this will be explained later. We We cut to a classroom where Sydney is staring at an empty desk beside her. Presumably, this used to be Casey Becker's seat. Not long after that, Sydney is called to speak to the police. The principal of the school, Principal Himbry, Sheriff Burke, and Dewey, or, to be more formal today, Deputy Riley, are awaiting Sydney in the principal's office. Mr. Himbry begins to allude to some presumably tragic past event that Sydney is connected to, but stops as she walks in the door. The sheriff asks Sydney if she knew Casey Becker, and then we cut to a fountain outside on the campus where Sydney and Tatum are with their respective boyfriends, Billy and Stu Mocker, and their mutual friend, Randy. They're all discussing what questions the police asked them. The guys were asked if they'd like to hunt since both Casey and Steve's bodies were gutted. Tatum says that she wasn't asked that question, and Stu says that's because there's no way a chick could have killed them. Tatum calls Stu out on his sexism and cites Basic Instinct as an example where the killer was female. Randy points out that the weapon in the movie was an ice pick, so it's not the same situation. Thank you, Randy. Very helpful. Sydney asks how you got someone, and Stu tells her in very graphic detail. Billy glares at Stu and says, "Hey, it's called tact, you fuckrag." What an interesting word. Tact. Anyway, Sydney asks Stu if he dated Casey, and Stu says it was very brief. Randy asks if the police know that Stu dated one of the victims, and he takes offense to Randy's accusation. Tatum asserts that Stu was with her last night, and she asks Randy where he was. Randy was working. Tatum seems surprised. At the video store? I thought they fired your ass. They did. Twice. Perhaps it'll be third time's the charm. Randy and Stu continue to bicker back and forth continually, and Sydney has had enough of it, so she leaves. Stu makes a horrible pun, saying live her alone instead of leave her alone, since they were joking about storing the victim's internal organs in mailboxes, and Billy rightfully hits him in the arm for doing so. Cut to Sydney arriving home from school and on the phone with Tatum. Since her dad's out of town for the weekend, Sydney is thinking it might be better for her to stay with Tatum. Tatum says she'll pick Sydney up after practice and asks Sydney if she's alright. Sydney says she is, but all the police reporters make it feel like deja vu all over again. Tatum promises to pick Sydney up after 7, and she hangs up. Sydney goes inside and locks her doors. We cut to Sydney gathering things to pack up and take with her to Tatum's. She sits on the couch and tries to watch some TV, but every channel is nothing but news stories about the murder of Casey and Steve. Casey tries to flip through the channels to escape the news, but to no avail. She stops on one channel where she sees the reporter she stared down earlier in the day at school. We now learn that the occurrence everyone has been alluding to thus far occurred the previous year when Sydney's mother, Maureen Prescott, was raped and murdered. After hearing the reporter bring this up, Sydney switches the TV off. She walks over to another couch and looks at a framed picture of herself and her mother. Sydney then stretches out on the couch. Time passes. Night falls. We fade up to see that the clock on the table reads 7:15 and the phone rings, waking Sydney up. It's Tatum calling to tell her that practice had ran late, but she's on her way. Sydney observes that it's after 7, but Tatum tells her that Casey and Steve weren't murdered until well after 10 o'clock. Sydney sarcastically notes how comforting that thought is. Tatum plans on stopping at the video store on the way over. Apparently there's a scene in the movie All the Right Moves where if you pause at the right time, you can see Tom Cruise's penis. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this type of future knowledge. Anyway, Sydney just tells Tatum to hurry and hangs up. The phone rings again and Sydney answers it, thinking it's Tatum calling back. Instead, it's a gravelly male voice that Sydney doesn't recognize, but the audience clearly does, since it's the same voice that spoke to Casey before she and Steve were killed. Sydney thinks it's Randy after the voice compares the situation in town to something out of a horror movie. The voice asks Sydney if she likes scary movies, and Sydney replies that she doesn't watch them. The voice asks if it's because she's scared, but it's not. What's the point? They're all the same. Some stupid killer stalking some big-breasted girl who can't act and is always running up the stairs when she should be going out the front door. It's insulting. The voice asks Sydney if she's alone in the house, and Sydney tells Randy she's disappointed in his lack of originality. The voice replies, maybe that's because I'm not Randy. Sydney starts to get concerned. She asks the caller who he is. The caller replies, it's not who am I, it's where am I. So Sydney asks where he is, and the voice replies, your front porch. Why would he be calling from the front porch? That's the original part. Suspenseful music plays as Sydney says she calls his bluff, opens the front door, and steps onto the porch to find nothing. She asks the clerk if he can still see her on the porch after he, and after he says he can, Sydney decides to taunt him by picking her nose and yelling, "What am I doing?" in hopes of getting a reaction. Hearing nothing, she still thinks it's Randy and gets ready to hang up. The voice turns angry. "If you hang up on me, you're gonna die just like your mother." The voice asks Sydney if she wants to die because her mother sure didn't. She curses at the voice, calling them a cretin, and quickly retreats back into her house, locking the door behind her. Suddenly, the killer bursts out of a closet behind Sydney and attacks her. A scuffle ensues. Sydney is able to briefly overpower her attacker and tries to escape out the front door. Unfortunately, she deadbolted the door after locking it and is unable to undo the latch in the franticness of the moment. So in true horror movie fashion, she runs up the stairs instead, with the killer not far behind. Sydney runs into her room and uses the closet door to keep the killer barricaded outside. She picks up the phone in her room in order to call the police, but finds the line is still in use from the earlier call. She instead accesses a teletype relay program in her computer, you know, the kind of service that deaf people use in order to make phone calls, and connects to 911 that way. Just as the operator gets in contact with her, the killer has vanished. Just as suddenly, Billy appears at Sydney's window. He heard the screaming and tried to come in, but the front door was locked. Sydney is crying, saying that the killer is in the house, but Billy tries to reassure her, saying that he's gone as she hugs him close. At that moment, a cell phone falls to the floor. It's obviously not Sydney's, and she looks at Billy, suddenly fearful. She backs away as we hear sirens approaching the background. Billy calls after Sydney as she runs downstairs, asking her what's wrong. Sydney opens the front door, only to come face-to-face with the ghost face mask again. She screams! Dewey, who is holding up the mask, having found it discarded outside, screams too. Obviously the most heroic of the police force in Woodsboro. We cut to Billy being restrained over the hood of a police car, insisting he didn't do anything. As they haul Billy away, Tatum drives up horrified at the scene and apologizes profusely to Sydney for being late, and asks if she's alright. Dewey tells Tatum that she can't be here, and it's an official crime scene, and Tatum brushes him off, saying that Sydney's staying with them since Sydney's dad is out of town. Just as things seem to be calming down, a passing news van stops suddenly. Once again, the same reporter that we've seen makes an appearance. She starts at her camera and to get his gear, she strides purposely towards the house. A police vehicle drives by, and she thinks she spots Sydney in it as it drives by. She tries questioning Tatum, who refuses to speak. Finally, she asks, "Can you tell me anything?" And Tatum replies, "Yes, you're a real pain in the ass. Leave us alone." As she drives off, Kenny the cameraman has reappeared and gets reamed out for being overweight and slow. We cut to the police station. It seems as though they're having issues locating Sydney's dad. He's not registered at the hotel that he said he'd be staying at. Dewey tells Sydney not to worry, that they'll find him. Just then, someone brings Dewey some paperwork and information about the mask, and he excuses himself. Cut to the sheriff asking Billy why he has a cell phone on him. Let me pause from recapping the movie a moment here just to give you a little cultural context. This movie came out in 1996, almost 20 years ago, before cell phones were extremely prevalent in society. Sure, a lot of people had cell phones, but very rarely would your average high school student have one. Hell, in 1996, I was 13 years old. The thought of me having a cell phone never even crossed my mind. Honestly, I didn't even have a cell phone until my junior year of college. The fact that not everyone had a cell phone is what makes the sheriff questioning Billy about his possessing one most important. That's what's culturally significant in the context of the movie at this point. Now, with it being, you know, almost 20 years later, and you have, you know, kids in grade school with iPhones, I think it's kind of safe to say that this movie couldn't be made the same way these days. So while it may seem, you know, a bit dated with the shock over someone and having a cell phone and cell phones being cloned and so forth, like I said, it may seem like it dates the movie and makes it, you know, a movie indicative of its time, but all the same, as far as I'm concerned, it's a cultural milestone as far as movies are concerned. Okay, off my soapbox, back to the recap. Billy simply replies to the sheriff that everyone has one, not really, as I just said, and insists that he didn't make the phone calls. Billy's dad suggests that they check the phone phone bill, or even check with the phone company directly since they'll have all the records on file. The sheriff sarcastically thanks Mr. Loomis for his inputs. The sheriff asks Billy why he was at Sidney's house tonight and last night as well. Billy says he just wanted to see Sidney and continues to insist that he didn't kill anyone. The sheriff says they'll have to detain Billy until the phone records come in. Billy says that's crazy, and then he goes back to staring at Sidney through the office window. Cut to outside the police station, where a regular media circus has erupted. News vans and camera crews are all over the place. Once again, the canary yellow-clad reporter appears, and we finally learn her name, Gail Weathers. She attempts to make her way to the front of the police station and hopes to make contact with Sidney. Back inside, two officers are escorting Billy to a holding cell, and he continues to yell out to Sidney, asking her to tell them he didn't do it. Sidney can't even turn to look at him. Tatum comes into the police station and tells Sidney that she'll get her out of there. Dewey walks up to the sheriff in the back, containing a costume which is called Father Death. Apparently sold at every store in the state, so it'd be impossible to track the purchase of it. As for the phone records, they'll pull the info from the Loomis account, but they won't have anything until the morning. At this point, Tatum's patience is wearing thin, and she wants to live. Leave. Dewey tells her to wait a moment, but Tatum gives no fucks at this point and talks back to him, mortifying him in front of all his co-workers. The sheriff suggests they go out the back way to avoid the media madness. Gail asks Kenny, her cameraman, if there's a back entrance to the police station, and Kenny indicates a nearby alley. Dewey, Tatum, and Sidney all exit out the back door, and Dewey goes on ahead to bring the car around for them. Unfortunately, Gail spots them and swoops in to try and get a word with Sidney. Tatum tells Gail to leave them alone, but Sidney says it's okay. Gail's just trying to do her job. Sidney asks Gail how her book is coming along, a book that we later learn is about the Woodsboro murder case in which Sidney's mom was the victim. Gail says it'll be out later this year. Sidney says she'll look for it, and Gail replies that she'll send Sidney a copy. Sidney then turns around and punches Gail in the face, sending her sprawling backwards into her camera. The girls leave the scene as the other reporters have swarmed in, catching the aftermath of the punch. Cut to Tatum's bedroom, where she and Sidney are in their pajamas, and Tatum gleefully recounts what we just saw, and I quote, "I'll send you a copy. Bam! Bitch went down." Well, it's an accurate retelling, at the very least. Dewey comes by and tosses Sidney an ice pack for her hand, saying that he'll be right next door if they need anything. Dewey leaves, shutting the door behind him. Tatum asks Sidney if she thinks Billy's the killer, and Sidney defeatedly replies that Billy was there tonight after the masked fugitive seemingly vanished. I knew he had to have some kind of flaw. He seemed too perfect. Way to be the supportive friend, Tatum. Mrs. Riley knocks at the bedroom door, saying there's a phone call for Sidney. She asks if it's her dad, but Mrs. Riley doesn't think so. Tatum suggests they take a message, but Sidney says she'll take the call and heads downstairs. We cut to downstairs, and Sidney has picked up the phone. The killer's voice greets her on the other end, taunting her for getting Billy arrested. Looks like you fingered the wrong guy. Again. Sidney asks who this is, and the voice says that she'll know soon enough and hangs up. Mrs. Riley calls out to her son, and Dewey emerges from his bedroom with his gun drawn. Tatum and Mrs. Riley escort Sidney back upstairs, and Dewey picks up the phone and says hello, getting no response, because, as we heard, the killer hung up. Yeah. Woodsboro's finest, apparently. Cut to the next day, and the first appearance of the song Red Right Hand in the series of this movie. Whenever you hear this song in the Scream film, shit's about to go down. A morning news story recounts the events of last night and reminds everyone that Sidney's the daughter of Maureen Prescott, who was murdered last year. More exposition occurs in the news story as we get the first mention of Cotton Weary, whom Sidney testified was the man who murdered her mother and is currently awaiting an appeal. Dewey tells Sidney that they released Billy because his cell phone record was clean, but the police are tracing every cell phone in the county and making note of any calls that were made to both Sidney and Casey. We cut to the campus of Woodsboro High School. News vans and police are all over the scene again. Dewey gives Sidney and Tatum what could laughably call a police escort. Dewey tells Sidney that she'll be safe at school. To illustrate his point, a reporter rushes up to Sidney and asks her how it feels to almost have been brutally butchered. Sidney walks off, spotting Gail in the distance. Sidney tells Gail she's not here to fight, she wants to talk, but off the record. Gail initially refuses, but Sidney says Gail owes her at least that much to her mother. We learn that Gail believes that Cotton Weary was not guilty of the murder of Maureen Prescott, and that Sidney misidentified him as such, convinced that someone framed him. Sidney says she knows she was right, but Gail detects doubt in Sidney, saying that those recent murders and the murder of her mother seem to be linked. The killer's still out there. Tatum shows up and leads Sidney away, and they head to class. Gail seems to be thrilled at the prospect of being able to prove Cotton innocent and save him from death row. Imagine it would do for my book sales! Gale Weathers, humanitarian. Cut to Sydney at a locker talking to Tatum and Stu. She's convinced that coming to school today was a mistake. Just then, someone runs by wearing the Father Death costume, screaming at the top of their lungs. Sydney is justifiably horrified. Stu loves it, saying it's like Christmas. Tatum says there's a stupidity leak and hits Stu on the forehead with her lollipop. That's not a euphemism. She really does have a lollipop in this scene and hits him on the head with it. Sydney rushes off in tears and literally runs into Billy. Billy continually tries to convince Sydney he had nothing to do with the murders, but just comes off as increasingly creepy. And for some reason, Billy thinks this is the ideal time to discuss the relationship, noting that Sydney hadn't been the same since her mother died. Tomorrow will be the one-year anniversary, and Billy thinks that maybe now should be the time for Sydney to get over that. When my mom left my dad, I just accepted it. I know she's never coming back. Sydney points out that his parents splitting up and his mom leaving town is not the same as her mother being murdered. Billy admits it's a bad analogy and says he just wants his girlfriend back. This is obviously not the reaction Sydney wanted, and she storms off crying. This turns out not to be the reaction Billy was expecting either, and he calls himself stupid. We cut to Principal Himber's office, where he's yelling at the two students who are wearing the ghost face masks, not entertained by their little prank. He expels him, and one of the boys says, "That's not fair." Principal Himber replies that the boy's right. It's not fair. Fair would be to rip their guts out and hang them from a tree so they'd be exposed as the desensitized little shits they are. Damn, Fonzie, taking a level in badass. Oh yeah, Mr. Henry, the principal, is played by Henry Winkler. Just thought I'd share that piece of information here. We now cut to Sydney walking to the girls' bathroom. She hears two girls talking shit about her in a couple of stalls, and then retreats into a handicap stall once she hears a toilet flush, not wanting further confrontation. One of the girls says that she thinks Sydney made up the story, and perhaps even killed Casey and Steve herself. This genius further goes on to hypothesize that seeing her mother get butchered royally destroyed Sydney mentally, making her suicidal, but she decided that teen suicide is out this year, and homicide is a much healthier expression of her inner turmoil. The two proto-mean girls leave, and Sydney emerges from the stall she hid in. Just then, she hears a voice faintly calling her name. She crouches down and sees only empty stalls, no feet on the floor of any of them. She stands back up again and hears the voice once more. This time calling out, "Is anyone there?" which, as we have learned, is a major mistake in a horror movie. She crouches again and once more sees no one in the stalls. But she stands back up, we hear movement. Suddenly, a figure steps down from on top of a toilet in the furthest stall, and we see their black boots, pants, and the cloak of the costume come into view. The stall door darts open, and Sydney makes her move, running towards the bathroom door, sliding under the killer, and managing to escape just in time. We cut to outside, where Gale and Dewey encounter one another for the first time. Gale flirts with Dewey and tries to sweet-talk some information out of him. He resists, for the most part. Dewey admits that there are no real leads, and that they've been unable to locate Sydney's father. He's not officially a suspect yet, but the police aren't ruling him out as a possibility. Principal Himbry's voice comes on over the PA system saying that due to recent events, all classes are suspended until further notice, and the Woodsboro Police Department is issuing a citywide curfew starting at 9 p.m. that night. Dewey heads off, but tells Gale that she's much prettier in person. So smooth. Cut to Tatum and Sydney walking out of school, and giving this latest attacks, Tatum tells Sydney that she's no longer allowed to be alone. To quote, "If you pee, I pee. Got it?" Stu runs up and is thrilled that school's been canceled and thanks Sydney for making it all possible. "You're really kind of an asshole, Stu." He then suggests an impromptu party at his place to celebrate this recent turn of events, and Sydney, while reluctant at first, decides to go. We cut to Principal Himbry messing with the confiscated ghost face mask in the mirror in his office. There's a knock at the door and he goes to investigate. No one's there. Turning back into his office, he startles himself by seeing the mask reflected in the mirror. He tosses the mask aside and fixes his hair, effectively regaining his cool, so to speak. Then there's another knock at the door, and once again, no one is there. He walks out of his office into the hallway, trying to find those little shits. A voice responds, "What did you call me?" And we see a janitor wearing a red and green striped sweater and a hat washing the floor. Principal Himber replies, "Not you, Fred." Get it? In case you don't, that was a reference to A Nightmare on Elm Street. And fun fact, Wes Craven played Fred the janitor in that brief scene. Now, back to our movie. Principal Henry returns to his office and slowly approaches the wardrobe in the corner of the room. He opens the door and finds a portal to Narnia! I mean, a bunch of his jackets hanging there. He brushes some of the jackets aside and startles himself in the mirror again. Honestly, I can't blame him for being jumpy given everything that's happened so far. He goes over to close the door to the office, revealing the killer was hiding there the entire time. The killer stabs Mr. Hembree and he says his catchphrase, "Ayy!" Sorry, I mean, "Ah!" School's Out by Alice Cooper plays as that scene ends. Cut to Sydney and Tatum talking on Tatum's porch. Tatum asks Sydney what if Cotton is telling the truth and that he was having an affair with Maureen. Sydney asks if that were the case, why couldn't Cotton prove it in court? Tatum's response, well, you can't prove a rumor. That's what makes it a rumor. Sydney says that the rumor was made up by Gail Weathers, but Tatum says that she'd been hearing talk about other men and not just Cotton. Sydney asks Tatum if she believes that, and Tatum says you can only hear that Richard Gere gerbil story so many times before you have to believe it. No, I'm not explaining that one. Google it on your own time. Sydney says that if Cotton is innocent, then the killer is still out there, and Tatum chides her for starting to sound like a Wes Carpenter movie. The two girls go inside and get ready for Stu's party, and then we pan up to see someone in the Ghostface costume run through the trees, likely having watched the whole conversation from a distance. Cut to the video store where Randy is, I guess, hard at work. Stu shows up and asks Randy if he's coming to the party tonight. He is, due to getting off work early because of the curfew. Randy spots Billy standing in the horror section and says that's in bad taste. If you were the only suspect in the massive bloodbath, would you want to be standing there? Stu says it was obviously a misunderstanding since the police let Billy go, but Randy is not convinced, saying the police don't watch enough horror movies and that this is standard horror movie stuff. Stu asks Randy why Billy would try to kill his own girlfriend. There's always some stupid bullshit reason to kill your girlfriend, Randy says. Randy asks Stu if he thinks Sydney would go out with him since Billy tried to kill her. Stu laughs in Randy's face, then tells him point blank, no. Stu suggests that Sydney's dad is the killer, citing the fact that no one can find him. Randy says they probably can't find Mr. Prescott because he's dead. His body will probably pop up during the last reel somewhere. Randy says the very simple formula and yells, everyone is a suspect, drawing maybe just a little too much attention to himself. Randy says that Mr. Prescott's a red herring. He's convinced it's Billy. Randy turns to walk away and runs right into Billy, who doesn't take too kindly to Randy's accusations and asks how do they know he's not the killer. Randy is so obsessed with movies, how can they be sure he hasn't lost touch with reality? Randy admits that if this were a scary movie, he'd probably be the prime suspect. They ask what his motive would be, and Randy says, it's the millennium. Motives are incidental. Billy and Stu are very entertained by this as Randy walks away. As Randy watches Billy leave, Randy is now even more convinced of his theory. We cut to a montage of people leaving the town square and businesses closing early because of the curfew. Red Right Hand plays once again, and for much longer this time. Dewey, Tatum, and Sydney arrive in town so the girls can pick up food for the party, and Dewey needs to check in at work. Tatum asks Sydney if they made a movie about this, who would play her? Sydney doesn't want to think about it. Dewey says he sees Sydney as a young Meg Ryan, but Sydney says it's more likely they'd cast Tori Spelling, knowing her luck. As Tatum and Sydney shop, Sydney can't help but agree with Billy. Every time he tries to touch her, she withdraws. Tatum says that Sydney can't be blamed for having intimacy issues due to her mother's untimely death. Sydney says that Billy's been real patient with her about all the sex stuff and doesn't think that there are many guys who would be. Tatum sums things up thusly. Billy and his penis don't deserve you. Cut to Sheriff Burke smoking a cigarette outside the police station. Dewey arrives holding an ice cream cone, which he periodically eats during the conversation. The phone company faxed over the records. The calls came from Neil Prescott, Sydney's father's phone. Dewey asks if there was a way for the cell to be cloned, but gets no answer. Sheriff Burke further says that tomorrow's the anniversary of Mrs. Prescott's death. The plan is to keep the curfew in effect and the roadblocks up for the duration of the night. If they don't find Mr. Prescott during that time, they'll do a house-to-house search in the morning. Dewey asks Sheriff Burke if he should bring in Sydney to the station, but Burke says they'll wait until they're sure Mr. Prescott is the one they're looking for, but Dewey should keep a close eye on her all the same. We cut to Stu's house, where the party is well underway. Dewey drops the girls off, and Gail's news van isn't too far behind. Gail and Dewey encounter each other on the road near the house. Dewey asks Gail what she's doing there, and she says you never know when a rare story will pop up. Dewey says not much of a story, just a bunch of kids cutting loose. Gail asks Dewey what he's doing here, and Dewey says he's just keeping an eye on things. Dewey says he was going to go check out the party, and Gail asks if she can come with him. Dewey is all too happy to have her come along. Gail grabs her coat and a small camera from Kenny as they head up to the house. Back at the house, Sydney is looking at a bunch of movies that Randy brought along and wonders why Jamie Curtis is in so many of them. Randy tells Sydney that it's because she's the Scream Queen. Stu replies, with a set of lungs like that, she should be. Tatum helpfully explains that Stu was talking about her tits. The doorbell rings and Stu goes to answer it, asking Tatum to grab him another beer while he does so. Stu tells the partygoers that Gale Weathers was at the door. Tatum and Sydney are noticeably displeased about this. Tatum even more so when she sees that her brother is with Gale. Dewey goes to talk with Sydney and she asks if they found her father yet. Dewey says that they haven't. Sydney asks if she should be worried, and Dewey tells her not yet. Randy excuses himself to go and grab a camera, possibly wanting a photo op with a local newswoman. As this is happening, Gale makes her way toward the entertainment center in the living room and places the camera right below the TV. We cut to Tatum in the garage. She opens the garage door slightly in order to turn the lights on. She walks over to the fridge to get some beers, and the door shuts behind her. A pile of gardening equipment is knocked over, startling Tatum. We see this was caused by a cat who runs through a door built into one of the garage doors. Tatum regains her composure and walks back to the door, only to find that it is shut and locked behind her. The lights then shut off. She knocks on the door to try to get someone's attention in the house, but to no avail. She decides to go out the garage and go back into the house during the front door. The garage door opens halfway, but then suddenly closes before she's able to duck out. Tatum turns around and sees someone wearing the Ghostface costume standing by the door controls. Tatum thinks it's Randy and tells him to lose the costume or else it'll upset Sydney. She tries to push past, but the figure won't let her. "Oh, you want to play Psycho Killer?" The figure nods yes. Tatum plays along very unconvincingly. "Please don't kill me, Mr. Ghostface. I want to be in the sequel." She tries to push past again, but to no avail. It becomes apparent to Tatum that this isn't Randy when the costume individual pulls out a knife and cuts her along the arm. She retreats into a corner as the killer comes after her. She retaliates by throwing beer bottles at him. One hits him in the crotch and the other in the face. Tatum attempts to crawl through the cat door and escape, but gets stuck halfway through. The killer activates the garage door and it rises, killing Tatum by crushing her. We cut back to the foyer of the house as people are leaving. Sydney calls out for Tatum, and Stu says that he hasn't seen her. Just then, Billy shows up. He says he was hoping to get to talk to Sydney alone. Stu says he can use his parents' bedroom to talk, or whatever. Billy tells Stu that he needs to look up the definition of subtlety. Sydney says it's okay, they do need to talk, and Billy walks in, giving Stu a ball tap as he passes in the process. The two of them head upstairs as Randy walks in. "There goes my chance with Sid," he says. Stu replies, "as if," and Randy mockingly calls him Alicia in response. I should probably watch Clueless for this podcast at some point. That was a damn fine movie. Anyway, Randy says he's gonna go check on Billy and Sydney. Cut to Kenny back in the news van, trying to get his monitor to display the feed from the hidden camera. As the picture comes in, Gale arrives back at the van, but she's still on screen. Turns out there's a delay, probably 30 seconds or so. Gale says it's fine and just tells him to record the feed. Gale asks Kenny if a cheesy tabloid journalist has ever won the Pulitzer Prize, and Kenny says, "as a first time for everything." Cut to Billy and Sydney in the bedroom. Billy starts to apologize, but Sydney cuts him off, saying that she should be the one apologizing for being so selfish and self-centered because of all the post-traumatic stress she's been going through. She says Billy was right. She can't keep wallowing in the grieving process forever and has to stop worrying she'll end up like her mother. Sydney says she knows it doesn't make sense, but Billy says it does and cites the Silence of the Lambs when Jodie Foster's character keeps having flashbacks about her dead father. Sydney says this is real life, not a movie. But Billy says it's all just one big movie. You just can't choose your genre. Sydney wonders why she couldn't be a Meg Ryan movie. Or even a good porno. Billy's taken aback by this and asks Sydney if she's sure. Sydney says she thinks so and they begin making out. Cut to a living room where a small group of people that decide to stare watching Halloween. Stu is more interested in seeing Jamie Lee Curtis's breasts, but Randy tells him she never went topless until Trading Places in 1983. Curtis always played the virgin in horror movies, and that's why she was always able to outsmart the killer. Only virgins can do that, according to the rules. Randy is pissed that no one else apparently knows the rules, and we get this speech.
There are certain rules that one must abide by in order to successfully survive a horror movie. For instance, number one, you can never have sex. No, no, no. Big no-no! Big no-no!
dead man.
Human popcorn. Sex equals death. Okay. Number two, you can never drink or do drugs. No, the sin factor. It's a sin. It's an extension of number one. And number three, never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say I'll be right back, because you won't be back.
I'm getting another beer. You want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back.
You see, you push the laws and you end up dead. Okay, I'll see you in the kitchen with a knife.
We then cut to Gail and Kenny, who are sitting in the news van, watching the feed, bored out of their minds. Suddenly there's a knock at the door. It's Dewey. The sheriff just radioed saying that they found a car in the bushes nearby and are investigating. He asks Gail if she'd like to come along. Gail gladly accepts and tells Kenny that she'll be right back. As she leaves, Kenny turns the volume back on and we hear the very end of Randy's speech, right after he brought up the danger of saying, "I'll be right back." Dewey flirts awkwardly with Gail as they decide to walk to where the car was found. And to think, these two got married in real life. Cut to some more people leaving the party and an even smaller group still watching Halloween. It is interspersed of shots of Billy and Sydney upstairs getting ready to have sex. Suddenly the phone rings. Randy answers it. Principal Himbry is dead. His body was gutted and hung up on one of the goalposts at the football field. Everyone else decides they've got to see this before they take the body down, so they leave, and Randy plops back down on the couch to watch the movie by himself. Cut to Dewey and Gail walking along, and we learn that Dewey's real name is Dwight, and that Dewey is just a name that he got stuck with a long time ago, and says being called Dewey is just the town's way of not taking him seriously. Gail says that having her name is no picnic either. Sounds like she'd be a meteorologist, and people treat her like she's the Antichrist of TV journalism. Dewey says that he doesn't think Gail is so bad, but Gail thinks that's maybe that just because he likes her. Suddenly, they notice the cars of the kids leaving the park come up behind them. They're coming up very fast and completely ignore Dewey's commands to slow down and freeze. So Dewey dives and pushes Gail out of harm's way, and they both go tumbling through the bushes, Dewey landing on top of Gail. They kiss briefly, but Dewey breaks it off, saying that he's on duty. Gail laughs and looks aside, drawing Dewey's attention to something. It's the car that was reported, and it's Neil Prescott's. Dewey wonders why he would be there, and they decide that they need to get back to the house. Now. Cut to the bedroom where Sydney and Billy are getting dressed. Billy asks Sydney if she's okay, and Sydney says that she's fine. A few seconds pass, and Sydney asks Billy who he called after he was arrested. Billy says he called his dad. Sydney thinks that can't be right because she saw Sheriff Burke call Mr. Loomis. Billy says that when he called, he didn't get answers, and asks Sydney if she still thinks he did it. Sydney says no. Billy asks Sydney what does he have to do to prove that he's not a killer, and just then the killer shows up and stabs Billy in the stomach. Well, I'd say that's proof enough. Sydney runs through the house, trying to escape, coming to a room that resembles an attic. It seems that she's trapped, but Sydney finds a window to climb out of and makes it to the roof. In the meantime, the killer's gotten to the room and tries to pull her back through the window, but the killer loses his grip and Sydney falls, cushioned by a large tarp draped over a boat in the driveway. As Sydney recovers, she sees Tatum's corpse hanging from the garage door and stumbles away, trying to keep herself from vomiting. We cut back to the house, and Randy is very drunk, watching Halloween by himself. He calls out to Jamie Lee Curtis on the screen, telling her to look out because the killer is right behind her, not realizing that the Woodsboro killer is right behind him the entire time as well. Just as Killer's prepared to stab Randy, he looks away distracted by the sound of Sydney's distant scream. Sydney finds the news van and pounds on the door, waking up Kenny, who had fallen asleep. They both turn to attention to the feed and see the killer stalking Randy now. Kenny remembers the 30-second delay, and then the killer appears, slitting his throat. Sydney tries to lock herself inside the van, but not before the killer stabs her in the shoulder. Sydney is able to escape out of the back of the van, eluding the killer for the time being. Dewey and Gail approach the house. Dewey asks Gail if the van has a phone. It does. Dewey tells Gail to lock herself in the van and call the sheriff for backup. Dewey enters the house, gun drawn, jumpy at every sound, but finds no one. Gail returns to the van and starts calling for Kenny when she notices he isn't there. Pools of blood are forming on the ground near the van's side door. Gail grabs the phone and dials 911. Before she can speak to them, Gail comes up to the driver's side window and asks what's going on. Gail hits him in the face with the phone. She's not able to see anything out her windshield, so she turns the wipers on. Turns out the windshield was covered with blood. The wipers just further streaking it. Gail puts the van in reverse, and Kenny's dead body falls across the windshield from the roof of the van. She then puts the Vanity Drive and circles around trying to throw Kenny off the windshield. Gail speeds down the road, nearly hitting Sydney, but she veers off the road into an embankment, crashing into a tree. Sydney is running back towards the house, calling out for Dewey. The front door opens and Dewey comes stumbling out slowly before he slumps to the floor with a knife sticking out of his back. The killer appears, takes the knife, and wipes it off and stalks Sydney once more. She jumps into Dewey's police vehicle and locks herself in. Sydney tries to drive away but finds the keys are not in the ignition. The killer taps the window to get Sydney's attention and shows that he has the keys, taking them off of Dewey. He attempts to unlock the doors, but with no luck, as Sydney manages to keep them secured. The police radio springs to life and Sydney tries to call for help. As she does this, the rear hatch of the vehicle opens and the killer attacks again. Sydney manages to escape once more and runs toward the house, stopping to turn around but notices the killer has vanished again. As Sydney reaches the porch, Randy comes limping up, yelling that they've got to get out of there. She grabs Dewey's gun and points at Randy. Randy tells Sydney he found Tay's body and he's sure that Stu did it. Just then, Stu runs up, yelling that Randy's the killer. The two argue and plead with Sydney until she says, "Fuck you both," and slams the door, locking herself in. Just then, Billy comes crawling to the stairs and tumbles down them in an obviously weakened state. Sydney is relieved to see Billy alive, convinced that he was dead. Billy says he was struck pretty bad and they need to get help and reaches for the front door. Sydney tries to stop him, but Billy says it's okay and tells Sydney to give him the gun. They open the door and Randy rushes in saying that Stu's gone mad. Billy looks up and says, "We all go a little mad sometimes," and shoots Randy. Sydney rushes over to Randy as Billy licks the red substance that's on his fingers. Corn syrup. The same stuff they use for pig's blood and carry. Realization dawns on Sydney. She tries to get away from Billy, heading into the kitchen. She runs into Stu and pleads for help. Stu pulls out a white voice box and speaks into it. His voice sounds just like the mysterious caller's. Oh, no. Sydney now realizes that Billy and Stu were both in on it. Sydney tries to run, but they corner in the kitchen. Sydney asks what they're doing, why they're doing this, and Billy says it's all part of a game called Guess How I'm Gonna Die. What follows next is my favorite sequence of dialogue in the movie.
Fuck you!
No. We already played that game, remember? You lost.
Funny to me every time. Anyway, Stu and Billy say the rules of the game are as follows. They'll ask Sydney a question. If she gets it wrong, she dies. If she gets it right, she dies. Somehow this doesn't seem fair to me. Sydney says they'll never get away with this. Billy says, tell that to Cotton Weary. It was easy to frame him. Fun, too. So, yes, Billy and Stu killed Sydney's mother. Sydney asks why they did it, and Billy determines that just like Norman Bates and Hannibal Lecter, it's a lot scarier when there isn't a motive. Or, alternatively, Sydney's mom was having an affair with Billy's dad, and that's why his mom left. Maternal abandonment can lead to deviant behavior. Made you have sex with a psychopath. Stu then gets all giggly over the fact that Sydney's not a virgin anymore, tell her that she has to die now because it's the rules. Stu then tells Sydney they have a surprise for her, and he leaves the room to get it. Billy tells Sydney it's after midnight, so that means it's the anniversary of her mother's death. Stu comes back into the kitchen, dragging a bound and gagged Neil Prescott with him. Stu drops the voice changer and a cell phone into Mr. Prescott's pocket, revealing that they cloned his cell in order to make the calls. Here's how this movie ends in Billy and Stu's minds. The anniversary of his wife's death causes Mr. Prescott to snap, going on a murder spree topped off by killing Sydney and then shooting himself in the head, but just leaving Billy and Stu left for dead. Stu and Billy now tell Sydney it's time for the best parts. Billy asks Stu if he's ready, and Stu yells yeah while raising his arms. Billy stabs Stu, and then Stu does the same thing to Billy. Sydney says they've watched too many movies, and Billy snaps back, "Don't blame the movies! Movies don't make psychos, they just make psychos more creative," and Billy stabs Stu a few more times, possibly too many times to be safe. Billy tells Stu to get the gun so they can finish things, but finds the gun missing. Billy asks where it is, and we find that it is in the hands of Gail Weathers. She proposes this ending. The news reporter, left for dead, comes to, finds you two dipshits, grabs the gun, and shoots you both, saving the day. Sydney remarks she likes that ending. Billy confronts Gail and says that he knows something that she doesn't as Gail tries to pull the trigger, but to no avail. Billy kicks Gail, sending her crashing into a beam on the porch, knocking her unconscious. Turns out the gun works better when the safety is off. Billy prepares to shoot Gail and thinks Sydney would want to see this, but Stu turns back to the kitchen and sees Sydney and her dad are no longer there. Just then, the phone rings. Stu asks, "Shall I let the machine get it?" Billy picks up the phone, and the voice using the voice changer box asks Billy if he wants to play a game called Guess Who Just Called the Police on Your Sorry Motherfucking Asses. Billy yells at Stu to go find the Prescotts, but Stu is weak from blood loss and thinks he may be dying. Billy goes to search instead and tells Stu to keep talking to Sydney. She asks Stu what his motive will be, since Billy has one. Stu says peer pressure. He's much too sensitive. He asks Sydney if she really called the police, and Sydney assures him he did. Stu's response? He begins to cry and say that his mom and dad are going to be so mad at him. Billy goes searching for Sydney in the house as Halloween is still playing on the TV in the living room. Billy is briefly distracted by this, which allows a figure dressed in the Ghostface costume to come storming out of a closet and stab Billy in the chest with the point of an umbrella. We see that it was Sydney after she removes the mask and cloak. Stu comes staring out of the kitchen and charges Sydney. A struggle ensues with Stu on top of Sydney in the living room. Stu tells Sydney he always had a thing for her, and Sydney responds by biting Stu's hand and hitting him in the head with a vase of flowers. Sydney pushes the TV off its stand and it lands on Stu's head, electrocuting and killing him. Sydney walks into the hallway, examining the ghost face mask. A hand lands on her shoulder, and it's Randy! He's alive! Randy says he's sure he should be dead by now and never thought he'd be so glad to be a virgin. But his joy is short-lived as Billy pops up and punches him in the face. Billy holds Sydney down, attempting to strangle her. He growls, "Say hello to your mother," and Sydney reaches up and grabs him by the stab wound in his chest that she gave him. Billy howls in pain, and just as he's about to stab Sydney, Gale reappears and shoots Billy from the front door, sending him sprawling backwards, gasping and coughing as he breathes his last and dies. Gale quips from the doorway, "Guess I remembered the safety that time, you bastard." Sydney, Randy, and Gale all gather around and look down at Billy. Sydney nudges the body with her foot and gets no response. Randy warns them that this is the part where the supposedly dead killer comes back to life for one final scare. Billy suddenly gasps and sits up, but Sydney shoots him in the head. "Not in my movie," she says. Suddenly, someone bursts out from one of the other closets. It's Mr. Prescott, still tied up. Sydney and Randy help to free him as Gale looks on. We cut to outside as we see Dewey being loaded in an ambulance, miraculously surviving being stabbed the previous night. He asks where Gale is. We see that Gale has gathered a camera crew and is ready to film an eyewitness account of the events that occurred on the previous night, bringing a close to the mystery of the Woodsboro murders that have left the town in fear. We fade out on the sunrise and roll credits. So there you have it, the first Scream movie. Arguably one of Wes Craven's best. And one of my favorite movies, too. Not just favorite horror movies, but favorite movie in general. As I said, it was the first horror movie I ever saw from beginning to end, so of course that kind of resonates with me. I really enjoyed watching this movie again. In fact, I enjoyed all the Scream movies. In fact, the Scream Trilogy box set was one of the first DVD collections that I picked up when my family had gotten our first DVD player back in the year 2000, 2001, something like that. In fact, it was the Scream Trilogy box set and the first season of The Simpsons on DVD. God, that seems so long ago. Anyway, thank you for your patience in waiting for this episode. As I said, I wanted to try and get this one out in time for Halloween, but circumstances being what they were, I wasn't able to. But you know, like I said, I enjoyed the fact that I was busy with rehearsals and performances for Rocky Horror during that time. Wasn't very glad to be spending a whole lot of time at work during that time, but I guess you gotta take the bad with the good. And, you know, again, you know, the roughly 2 weeks of cold that set me back from recording a while. So, again, I thank you for your patience. I hope you enjoyed listening to this. I'm not sure what's going to be next. I'm going to try to hopefully get at least another episode out before November is over. I'm going to possibly do some Christmas-themed episodes for December. Thinking of having a special episode of Witty Banter up sometime in December before the year's end, and hopefully making a huge comeback with Witty Banter and the other podcasts into the new year, especially now that I have this new Snowball microphone, which I think sounds terrific. And I hope you all feel the same too. So, this comes to the point of the show where that's it for this week, and all I have to do is thank you very much for listening. Questions, comments, feedback, and so forth can be sent to chrismcg1983@gmail.com. That's chrismcg1983@gmail.com. become my friend on Facebook. Just search for Chris McGinnis. Like the fan page for my podcast, which is Thoughts Out of Context Productions. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at DramaGuyCJM. That's DramaGuyCJM. Consider becoming a patron of the show by visiting my Patreon page. That's www.patreon.com/DramaGuyCJM. That's patreon.com/DramaGuyCJM. And by becoming a patron for contributing as little as $1 for a podcast episode, I will gladly thank and acknowledge you by name at the end of every podcast episode I do, and so we've come to that point, so thank you, as always, to my current patrons, Rachel Delecta and Eddie Landis. Your support is most appreciated. Okay, so that will do it for now, clocking in at a little over an hour. So, until next time, thank you for listening to Everything is Fantastic. This is Chris McGinnis saying have a good week.